Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So last week I was invited to give a talk at a Tibetan center, Nyingma center in Berkeley, and they had sponsored a Tripitaka recitation and went over a period of 3 days, and one of the nights I was invited to give a talk. They asked me to talk on the, I think it was the title, was Awakening Mind and Merit. I don't know, something about, anyway, how it ties in with the Eightfold Path and Four Noble Truths. They were trying to cover everything. But the main aspect of it was the topic of merit, which is, it's not really talked about that much in kind of Western Buddhism, with air quotes around that. I think part of it is just the word merit sounds kind of dumb, actually. In the sense of, when you're in Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts and you get a merit badge or something. But that doesn't really convey what the Buddha is pointing to. Because the word that the Buddha uses is punya. And it's actually a very difficult word to translate. Because I often get that where Thai people living in America or in the West, and they'll oftentimes ask, because they're stumped, how do you translate punya into English? In Thai, they just use the same word, basically, bun. It has so many shades of meaning. So they'll oftentimes ask me, how do you translate that? And actually, I often say, I have no idea. I don't know how to translate it properly, because it doesn't really convey what it means. And it's helpful to look back at what the Buddha himself says about punya. Because there's one discourse in the Itivuttaka where the Buddha says, do not be afraid of merit, or don't be afraid of punya. Punya is another word for happiness, because what it is the result of skillful action, and it's kind of the happiness that arises as the fruit of skillful action, wise action, and action by body, speech, or mind, and something to be able to delight in. And you realize that the path of practice that the Buddha gives is actually, I think one of the ways that we relate to the path of practice or the whole kind of teaching of the Buddhas is that the Buddha is pointing to a path to the liberation of suffering, and that path is a path of wisdom and non-attachment. And when we look at it from that perspective, then all we need to do is kind of get that wisdom, not be attached, and be free from all suffering, reach liberation. And logically, that sounds pretty good, but it doesn't actually account for how we feel. And if we feel miserable all the time, all the miserable, tense, tight, all the time that we are practicing, then that's a... it's never really going to come to fruition. The path is never going to actually bear its fruit if we don't really know how to be at ease, to experience happiness, to dwell in a kind of delight in truth, in goodness, in what is really, path of integrity. There was a time when Ajahn Sumedho, when he first went to live in England to establish the monasteries in England, Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho went together on this invitation from England, and then Ajahn Chah left Ajahn Sumedho in England with a few other monks to establish, see what happened, see if it worked, see if there was enough interest to stay on, continue on. And one of the things he told Ajahn Sumedho when he left to go to the airport, to come back to Thailand, he said, stay here for 5 years, don't come back. And stick it out, don't come running back too quickly. So that Ajahn Sumedho did. He waited for 5 years, and before making his first visit back to Thailand and to see Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah visited 2 years after that initial visit to encourage and support. but it was Ajahn Sumedho's first visit back, and one of the things that he brought back was a gift from one of the English supporters, who was a sculptor, and it was a sculpted Buddha image, about that high, maybe about 9 inches high or something, 9-10 inches high, a foot high, and he brought it, and when he arrived, and he presented it to Ajahn Chah, and then Ajahn Chah, and he set it at a little table beside there, and and the image was very, it was nice. It was very beautiful, but it was it was kind of as a Buddha image. It was a bit kind of a bit too upright, a bit too tight, a bit too tense. Sort of a Buddha image, sort of like this, very rigid. And Ajahn Chah kept sort of looking over and kind of smiling to himself. Finally, he couldn't hold it in any longer. He said, "Oh, that's really a Western Buddha. He's really tense." And there's that sense of oftentimes our our idealism and our kind of intellectual analysis of what we think we need to do or should do. It doesn't mean it's not right, but oftentimes how it's held is in a way that doesn't actually give us much happiness. And that's one of the main functions of punya, is how do we practice this path and be able to bring benefit and well-being to ourselves and benefit and well-being to others. And that's a function of punya. So that's an aspect to be reflecting on and considering, because it's how we're kind of nourished in the path. The basis of action that is considered punya, in the suttas, there's a bit of a difference. In the suttas, the Buddha just points to dana, sila, bhavana, so that generosity, virtue, and cultivation, meditation, development, and then in the commentarial literature, they expand it a bit, and I think quite skillfully, because it sort of fleshes it out a little bit more and puts 10 bases of meritorious action or actions resulting in punya. And it starts with similar. It starts with the same ones: generosity, virtue, and bhavana, that cultivation. And there's many different forms of ways of manifesting generosity, but certainly the material giving, actually sharing and giving and being generous of what we have for the benefit of others, is a really important basis of, say, punya, and we say that a generous action results in well-being and happiness, because what it does is fundamentally undermines just the tendency to be selfish and selfish, self-centered. When we can relinquish that sense of self and the worry about self, the me, what's in it for me, what can I get? When it is, what can I give? That's a very different mental state. There's a lot more happiness in rather than worrying about what you can get. What can I give? What can I share? How can I help? That has a very different result. It has a very different effect on the mind, on the heart. So that quality of generosity is really an important avenue to cultivate this basis of happiness and being able to delight in sharing what one has, rather than worrying about how you can keep it and hold on to it, and so there's a lot of fear when that is the basis, and there's a lot of trust or when there's a basis of generosity. And that has a much more wholesome effect on a spiritual practice. Then fear and tightness and worry. So that you see that this, say, the function of punya is to open up some space, get some air in the system of our sense of self perception. The second quality is sila, or virtue, moral precepts. Maybe virtue, integrity are much better expressions of what sila is. So that the basis of all the precepts are the five precepts: not stealing, not killing, not stealing, refraining from sexual misconduct, maintaining skillful speech, and refraining from intoxicants. And then, say, like this evening being a observance night, and there's a some people can take on the eight precepts, where it's a bit of an expansion. There's a bit more of an element of renunciation, but still it's rooted in these fundamentals of the five precepts, even the precepts of novice, anagarika, of the all the monastics. Even though it's a lot of precepts, the spirit of it is in, I say, that non-harming of integrity and composure, and the and oftentimes the way that we can relate to the moral precepts are sometimes out of that sense of like moral commandments, which we pick up from a Judeo-Christian background. But that's really not the function of precepts from the Buddhist perspective. It's much more an opportunity to take on a standard of conduct which allows one to live in a way internally one has no need for a remorse or regret, and externally it has a benefit of creating a sense of trust and clarity in one's actions with others. And there's a very beautiful discourse where the Buddha speaks of the five great gifts, and you think, whoa, what are these five great gifts? What the Buddha does is then use the five precepts as a basis of that. So refraining from taking the life of any living creature is a great gift, because it it's a gift of safety, it's a gift of freedom, freedom from danger, freedom from oppression. And that's especially as any living being, and particularly on the human realm, then there's all these elements of fear and mistrust and kind of conflict and uncertainty and insecurity, that happens around the uncertainty of actions of people around us. To be able to live with people who have a very clear standard of conduct that is of high integrity and thoughtfulness, that's a real blessing. And so that to be able to do that oneself as a gift to others, of course it's a gift to oneself as well, that's the punya. There's a well-being and happiness that arises from that. The third quality that the Buddha points to says bhavana. So mental cultivation, mental development. So it's all the different forms of mental training, meditation, mindfulness. Those are so that as we pay attention to those elements of being mindful, being attentive, being circumspect in our both our external actions, internal moods and thoughts and feelings, then there's a sense of a natural sense of restraint, and there's a filter on how we interact, and there's an ability to both to restrain as well as relinquish what is unskillful, and then to make skillful choices to the cultivation of the wholesome, beautiful, and the ability to maintain and sustain those wholesome intentions and actions and qualities. So often, like in living with Ajahn Chah, when he would give a criticism of action, when he did something that was, not appropriate, not skillful, so often the admonishment was, "Oh, that's not beautiful," and that's a different feeling than it's wrong, it's bad. How could you be so pathetic? It's so that opportunity when we're cultivating, we're actually cultivating very beautiful qualities. Mental cultivation, developing that mindfulness, attunement to circumstances, loving kindness, compassion, generosity, integrity, all of those are actually very beautiful qualities that enhance our own well-being, but of course they have an effect on others. There's an appropriate sense of delight and happiness arises when we cultivate and develop the heart, the mind in that way. These are a source of well-being, and of course, in that cultivation, that's where we think. One of the qualities that the Buddha, when he depicted his path, there's a couple different ways when he spoke of his teaching, his way of training and practice, I mean, sometimes he'd say it's a way of wisdom, but he'd also say it's a way of effort. That's a viryavada. It's a way of effort. And so it isn't just a passive, waiting for somehow some magical liberating insight is going to sort of drop on one. But one has to put forth effort. But that effort, if it's strained or tense or tight, it's not going to yield fruit. So that the effort that we make has to be effort that we actually feel good about, and we can tangibly see that, this is something that brings happiness and well-being to ourselves and others. So that it's quite natural. So that's again this function of punya as a support and it's what buoys up our effort and sustains our effort and our intention. Because if one's just constantly pushing and forcing and or just enduring and gritting one's teeth so in order to try to maintain one's mindfulness or one's intention or one's aspiration, then you just get worn down after a while. And I've seen that so often, where whether it's in terms of sustaining practice or sustaining the intention of pursuing a monastic path. So whether one's a lay person or a monastic, this path does need to have some kind of support and something to sustain it. And to me, that's the function of punya. The other quality, the fourth quality that the Buddha or that they say, especially this is moving into the commentarial realm, but also these are not qualities that weren't ever mentioned by the Buddha, but it's kind of, it's brought into one kind of list. And the fourth quality is humility or reverence. And that's a incredibly useful quality, because so often our own sense of self, sense of me, that kind of constant refrain of I and mine and me, just gets in the way of practice, so that either the sense of having to prop up a sense of one's own self-worth, or holding up a sense of one's self-worth, or an inability to acknowledge and recognize the wholesome qualities or worthy qualities of somebody else. Those are they make us small, that make the heart small. So, whereas humility is an ability to not have to carry in this an exaggerated sense of I, me, and mine into any interaction. It's just that one can set that burden down and just act out of what is actually useful, beneficial, fruitful for oneself and others. That whole self position is extra baggage that just gets in the way. And then similarly, that sense of reverence, being able to acknowledge and see the wholesome or skillful qualities of somebody who has cultivated or who has exceptional qualities. Because what that does is then, takes the measuring of the world and self out of the realm of one's own limitations, and expands it to what is actually possible on the human realm. So that for myself, I felt just incredibly fortunate and blessed to have had the opportunity to train under a teacher like Ajahn Chah, who one could feel reverence towards most of the time. Because, the human beings you don't want to sort of idealize, but Ajahn Chah was really good at poking at our weaknesses or our defilements. It's like there was a senior monk who from our tradition who went to pay respects to one of the great forest masters, that monk went to this into the monastery of this great forest master, Ajahn Mahabua, and it gave him a really bad time. And so then when that senior monk came back and met with Ajahn Chah and told him the story of what happened in a kind of, he felt kind of slighted and offended. And Ajahn Chah's reaction was the funniest thing. He thought, "Oh, that's great." And he said he saw your defilements. As soon as you walked into the monastery gate, he saw your defilements, and you got your real fair and square on that one. So sometimes that it's uncomfortable, but this sense of there are beings who are worthy of reverence, it's important to draw close to them, because it encourages us, it gives us something to live up to, it gives tangible examples and models of something to aspire to, rather than something you read in a book. As nice as it is to read suttas or read spiritual masters in a book, isn't quite the same as human contact. So that quality of humility and reverence is a source of punya, because the one sets aside one's own sense of self, and then there's a lot of space there for that sense of happiness and well-being to arise. The next quality, the fifth quality, is acts of service, so that to be ready to help each other as human beings, and actually to give service, to pay attention to what's actually needed. And that's one of the things that I really cherish about the forest tradition, and also the way that Ajahn Chah trained us in the forest tradition, because there, for us as monastics, there's lots of ways that we have to pay attention to acts of service, how to look after each other, how to look after the monastery, how to look after the things that we rely on, we're given, the monastery. You start to develop an attitude of attentiveness to the things around you when you're engaged in actual service, doing something. Again, rather than it just being, having a nice theory, oh, I should be a good person, which, we should, but actually being, how do we implement that? So that those acts of service are ways of being attentive, and that in the northeast of Thailand, they have an idiom. If you want to know what the monks are like in a monastery, you go into a monastery. You want to know what the monks are like in the monastery, go take a look at the toilets. If you want to know what the teacher is like, take a look at the novices. So that you get a sense of, oh yeah, these are what kind of training, what kind of service is actually encouraged? How is it done? And and that kind of attentiveness to the things around us requires us to give of ourselves. It was actually today I took, we met with a contractor. We're looking at systems for heating and cooling for our new reception hall. And took the contractor around, went up into the building up the Bhikkhu Commons. And it was really impressive how neat and tidy the storeroom was, and how neat and tidy how the dining area was. And that takes acts of service. I mean, things don't magically get clean and neat and tidy. I mean, it's by everybody paying attention and helping to do that. Same with the workshop. So that attentiveness is and the willingness to to be of service in that way, and there's so many little ways that as human beings, especially living in community, that we have to look out for each other, help each other out. And those are all ways that are worthy of the mind stepping outside of its own narrow boundaries of its own concerns, and when we drop that, we actually open up possibilities of our happiness and well-being, because that we're actually having a human connection with each other. The next quality that is pointed to is the dedication of merit, dedication of blessings, so that both having the intention to do something that's skillful, and then holding in one's intention, in one's heart, the wish that, whatever the goodness that arises from this skillful action, may it be a benefit to others. And that's a, you know, that's a very beautiful intention. Holding that and recognizing that our actions aren't, they aren't fruitless, or we don't live in a vacuum, or we don't live in a moral vacuum. There's results to our actions of body, speech, and mind, and when we've actually brought up something that is a skillful intention, and then also acknowledging the skillfulness of our own actions, because it's easy to undermine ourselves or to kind of not give due credit to the skillfulness that we're actually engaging in. And when we don't do that, we don't actually receive the fruit of that. We don't actually delight in it. But so that when we recognize that, and then also bring up the intention, may that be a benefit to others. So it's like this evening, at tea time, usually we have on the observance at night, so I'll have a meeting with the Teras, the senior monks, and just have tea together. But right now there's people are traveling and missing, so that there was Ajahn Nyaniko as the sort of a single Tera. And then Ajahn Nyaniko and Thampu Muto are preparing to go on a tudong. So rather than having a Tera tea, we had a tudong tea. And just sort of talking over what they're going to do on this, their travels and preparations. And then one of the questions were, do you have any advice how to hold it? And I said, or what things to do? And I said, one of the things I think it's important to do is to, really every single day to get together and to do that chant of Metta Sutta, spreading of loving kindness and dedication of merit, so that as much as you're sort of practicing on your own, living on your, being on your own, but there's this acknowledgement of that you're, whatever you're doing, walking, meeting people, meditating, practicing this tudong, that it's that it's a benefit to others, and it so it's a, that dedication of merit, dedication of blessings. The next quality in this list that's pointed to is the to acknowledge and delight in the meritorious actions of others, in the goodness of others, like to anumotana, is to delight in the goodness of what's been done. And, you know, that's really an important quality, because sometimes we see somebody else doing something really, something good, something skillful, something that's really well done. And we oftentimes use it as a measuring stick towards ourselves, in the sense, either getting jealous or getting negative, or who does he think he is? Well, it's kind of a statement of, why didn't I think of that? And then we undermine ourselves rather than sort of say, well, somebody else does something really good, skillful, wholesome, and then to take delight in that, to anamotana, and to rejoice in the goodness of others or the skillfulness of others. That's sort of like the quality of mudita, which is sort of where that joy that one experiences in seeing other people's skillfulness or their happiness or well-being. And, you know, on a certain level, you know, this is the easiest one to do, because you don't actually have to do anything. It's just to, you know, acknowledge and recognize when somebody else does something, and then to delight in it. And it actually, you know, kind of ups the percentiles of your possibilities of experiencing happiness yourself. But it's one that's easily overlooked when that sense of self kicks in, or a sense of kind of comparing to others and giving oneself points of how good or bad one thinks oneself is. And it's just an extra layer of complication, which is really not necessary. There's this opportunity to anumota, delight in the goodness. The next quality that the the Buddha points to is, is hearing the Dhamma, hearing the teachings, listening to teachings, being. You know, a lot of it is sustaining the motivation for learning, for studying, for seeking out more understanding and knowledge of teachings that will lead one to truth. And that's the word Dhamma Savana, yeah, the hearing teachings. Listening, and of course nowadays there's just so many avenues say in the Buddha's time you'd actually have to go to somebody who was a teacher or somebody who had some knowledge, and to hear them, to listen. But you know, now it's with the and it's a lot. You don't have to walk. You can actually hop in your car and go. or you don't even have to hop in your car, you just turn your computer on, and you can access all sorts of Dhamma teachings. So to be able to to encourage oneself in that, and that, that hearing teachings that remind us of what this path is, what the opportunities are. Something that punya, we can delight in it, happiness. The next one, this is the ninth one, is the giving teachings, giving advice, which doesn't necessarily say like this, sitting up in front of an audience and having a mic in front of one, but it's the our interactions with our friends, our families, and to look for occasions of where you can bring up, not in a forceful way, but in really paying attention to where would be a suitable occasion, suitable teaching that might be a benefit to somebody who is either interested or is in need in some way of some guidance, and that's a giving of Dhamma, to be able to give, be ready to give, and it's important to use discernment as to what's an appropriate time. What's the appropriate occasion? What's a useful teaching that might be? It was like visiting a family a while ago, and he was talking about how much more easeful it is to go back with family because he's got past his Buddhist jihad phase and have him feeling obligated to sort of make sure that his family hears the teachings. It didn't really work. But when one's, attentive and skillful and thoughtful, reflective, and attuned to the circumstances, then when one does have the opportunity to give a perspective that's grounded in Dhamma, it's a real gift to people. As we all know, the world has got just the amount of input that is agitating and confusing is there's a lot out there that just keeps that confusion and agitation going, whereas the perspective that's more clear and grounded in truth is a real gift. The last quality that is pointed to is a straightening out one's views. And so in this sense, it's really being able to establish a right view, a view that's in accordance with truth, kind of correcting one's views. And this is something that aligning oneself with truth in terms of how one views things, because that's the the things that take precedence for us are usually what is taking precedence for us is usually either the sense of self, the pull of the self, or the kind of sticky, convoluted nature of that sense of self, or the similarly convoluted and sticky nature of the world. And one's views are always kind of shaped by the precedence or pull of that sense of self or the world, the external world. But then the Buddha said, you know, what is ideal, what we need to be trying to, what we need to allow to take precedence is the Dhamma. That's sort of the truth, having the weight rather than the self and the world having all the weight and pulling us into complication and confusion. So that straightening out in one's view so that Dhamma actually is able to take precedence, truth actually is able to take precedence. And of course that's the source of the greatest punya, the greatest happiness that can arise. And there's a there's a discourse, or I'm sure there's a few discourses where the Buddha speaks of a, what is it, a bonanza of merit, a bonanza of skillfulness, a nourishment of bliss. And it's sort of these are, but what it is actually the having confirmed confidence, and this is really, really straightening out one's views, having a, let's say, confirmed confidence in the Buddha, confirmed confidence in Dhamma, confirmed confidence in Sangha, and a like a confirmed confidence in the efficacy of sila and virtue, integrity, so that one is that's the foundation, one is unshakable in one's integrity and how one holds virtue. It's not held tight, but one understands the nature of cause and effect. And actually, that's the most common definition of stream entry, which is the first stage of liberation, of enlightenment. It's the first basis. And that's a, you know, so what the Buddha, you know, a bonanza of merit, a bonanza of skillfulness, nourishments of bliss. And so it sounds pretty good to me. So that sense of the place of merit and how happiness actually lays a foundation for one's ongoing practice, a nourishment of one's practice and one's training, that it's not just some, you know, some cultural accretion of making merit. It's integral to the path. And you think in terms of, say, that when the Buddha speaks of the in the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering. There is an origin of suffering. There's a cessation of suffering. There's a path leading to cessation of suffering. And you think, wow, that's pretty miserable. It's all about suffering. But you think, there is an origin. There's a causal process. And then that causal process it can be utilized to bring about the cessation of suffering. And then that path leading to cessation of suffering, of right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. All of the factors of the Eightfold Path are actually, every single factor when one applies any of those factors, it results in happiness and well-being. It's that whether it's view or intention, speech, it's all around skillful action that results in happiness and well-being. So that this is also, you know, again, sort of tying into to punya and learning how to nourish one's practice, one's efforts with something that uplifts and buoys up the heart. It's also sort of keeping one's eye on the goal, in the sense that one of the traditional ways of in any say again, I say the language is a bit, say like a merit-making ceremony. Merit-making ceremony, offerings that are made or whatever actions that are skillful. One of the traditional things of in a dedication of merit is also, there's a phrase, nibbana pachaya hotu. May this be a cause and condition for the realizing of nibbana. So that's a really reminding, recollecting, setting that intention that all of one's actions, if they're turned to skillfulness, and they'll be a source of giving a certain kind of oomph towards one's a practice and toward that goal of liberation, freedom, nibbana. So that those are some reflections this evening. I'll offer it up.
Sadhu.